Yeah, so my wife and I, Ginger and I, are sitting at the Poconos Camelback Lodge. And Camelback Lodge, and that was, as Randy said, October 2019. And we're speaking there, got here a day early, saw how beautiful it was. And said, this would be a great place to be invited back. And about a month later, I got a contact email from Jonathan Tice and said that Randy and David were at the event. And this would have been 2019 and wanted me to come here and speak. And, you know, COVID came about and so on. So, but this has all been planned for about a year and a half. And it's great to be here. And thanks for having me. Look forward to share a journey with you here tonight. I want to start this journey off when I was 32 years old. That was 5 years ago, by the way. That was 31 years ago. I'm 63 years old now. But this journey started when I was 32 years old. And that's kind of what I'm going to share here. Is it switching? Going to the next slide?
No.
Let's see here. I know it's on. Maybe need to point it this direction or?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So 32 years ago, I was with a company called Archer Daniels Midland, one of the largest companies in the world. I'm just going to go back one slide. And just imagine yourself for a minute. When you go back to work after this event, that you'll be taping your coworkers, your supervisors, and your friends, that you'll be recording them. Now imagine doing that 10 hours a day for 3 years. That's exactly what I did when I was 32 years old. I went to work, taped my coworkers, my supervisors, and my friends, unbeknownst to them. And I'm going to talk tonight about how I became an FBI informant in the first place. I'm going to talk about some huge mistakes that I made during the time I was an informant. But I'm going to talk about what God's getting to know God the last 25 years. And how my life was changed and how my life was transformed. And that's the journey I'm going to share. So it's a really messy story, but with a good ending. The company I was with 32 years ago, I was working for a company out of New York for 2 years called DeGusa, a large chemical company. And then they moved me to Frankfurt, Germany to their world headquarters for about 4 years. And during that time I was in Germany, I became vice president over acquisitions and mergers and joint ventures. And a company named ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, wanted to do some joint ventures together, and I was working with them on some of these joint ventures. And I have 6 years now with DeGusa, wonderful company, had a great mentor. And the CEO of ADM, he was about 75 years old. At this point, I would have been in my early 30s. And he said, Mark, why don't you come work for us? And company that we were doing some joint ventures with. And I said, I've been here 6 years. I couldn't imagine leaving. And Frankfurt, Germany, my wife and I, three kids, loved Europe. And he said, well, how much do you earn, Mark? And I said, well, it's a lot different when you look at income here in Germany and Deutschmarks. Then it was before euros came about. And I kind of calculated in my head 3 to 1, you know, Deutschmark to dollar. And I said, it's probably about $400,000 U.S. with base salary, stock options, and $400,000 doesn't go a long way in Frankfurt, Germany. It's very expensive to live there. And was there about 4 years at that point. And he said, well, Mark, how about if I give you about 9-10-fold that? After I spent about an hour telling him why I would never leave. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'll give you a base salary of $350,000 base salary, but I'll give you a contract if you meet certain performance parameters. You make $2 or $3 million every year with us. And they're performance parameters that you can really accomplish. These won't be hard to accomplish. Growth, revenues, profits, leading the division, be a divisional president. And he said, let me tell you a little bit about his company. He said, we're a public company on the New York Stock Exchange, one of the first companies on the New York Stock Exchange, he said. He said, at that point, $70 billion in U.S. dollar revenue, $70 billion, 30,000 employees. One of the largest food additive companies in the world. You can't buy a beverage or an iced tea or a food without something from ADM. And you buy a Pillsbury, a Kraft, a Sprite, or a Coca-Cola, or a Tyson chicken, it's got something from ADM in it. One of the largest food additive companies in the world. They and Cargill are the largest food additive companies in the world. So he said, I'll get it where you can earn $2 or $3 million a year. And I said, where do I sign? And this is after an hour telling him there's no way I'm leaving. I mean, I was 32 years old, graduated with my PhD at Cornell in biochemistry at age 25, so 7 years earlier. He said, Mark, you're going to be president of the biotech division. He said, you're going to report right to the COO. He said, you're going to be the fourth ranked executive of the company. I was visional president of the biotech division and corporate vice president of the whole company. CEO 75 years old, the president 69 years old. So there's three people above me and they're double my age. So all I had to do is be patient. I mean, the CEO was almost triple my age. All I had to do was be patient and I could be the number one or two on the 56th largest company on the Fortune 500. So I'm thinking, boy, I didn't believe in God at that time, but I'm thinking if there was a heaven, this is it. This is it. So I get there at ADM, moved from Frankfurt, Germany to Decatur, Illinois, and CEO came back to my office, the 75-year-old CEO, and said, it's my third day there in October 1989, 31 years ago, and he said, Mark, I want to take you out to the hangar. I got a Falcon 50 for you. The seven top executives each get their own jet, and he said, you're number four, so we got a Falcon 50 for you. And I had that job for about 8 years, and I can remember going to Phoenix for lunch and Manhattan for dinner the same day. And wasn't even any business involved. I mean, we should have went to prison just for what we did with those planes during that time. And probably with the SEC regulations now, you would go to prison for what we did. So I got a Falcon 50 my first week. So you can see where this is heading. I'm thinking I'm Bon Jovi. I'm Justin Bieber before Justin Bieber. Blonde hair blowing in the wind and the whole bit. And so I want to get to this slide here, show this home. So the CEO about third week came back to my house. He said, Mark, you moved your family from Frankfurt? And I said, well, Germany, yeah, I've been 3 weeks here. Haven't moved them yet. It takes like a month even just to move your furniture from Frankfurt, Germany. And I said, but we're talking to realtors, looking at homes. He said, why don't you buy my home? He said, he's been here about 30 years, 75 years old, wanted to move something smaller. I said, tell me a little about your home. He said, well, it's 13,000 square feet. Golf greens on the property, horse riding stables where your kids ride an inside arena heated in the wintertime if it's cold outside, living quarters in the horse arena, swimming pool, three golf greens, 8-car garage. I'm hearing all this and I'm thinking, this sounds like a little too much house for me. And I said, well, you know, I've been 7 years out of college. I think we'll get something a little smaller to start with. He said, nonsense. I'll give you a $500,000 startup bonus today. He said, oh, all the banks. Around here, he's a billionaire, largest shareholder of ADM. He said, I own all the banks. I'll make a phone call and get you a good interest rate. We should have went to prison just for that, some of the things that happened. So I got a $500,000 startup bonus my third week at work, corporate jet the first week. So I bought this house, moved my wife from Frankfurt, Germany. Her kids came in. Now, what's a guy fool himself do with an 8-car garage? You fill it up. I'm making, with bonuses, I'm making $300,000 a month, 31 years ago. That'd be $1 million a month today. So I like Magnum P.I., so I bought the same Ferrari that Magnum P.I. had, the red with the black snap-off top, bought two Mercedes, BMW, had an Alfa Romeo, had 8 cars in that 8-car, I had every garage filled up. My wife's driving around a 10-year-old Wrangler Jeep, the same Jeep we had that she brought back over because she didn't want to sell it and brought it back over from Germany and shipped it. 10-year-old Jeep wasn't worth sending it. She thought it was still good enough. She's driving that and I'm driving a $250,000 Ferrari. So that's where I was at age 32, living in that mansion. It was the CEO's house for 30 years. And before that, it was John Daniels, the founder of Archer Daniels Midland's home that he built in 1846, 100 years earlier. This was a mansion built by the founder of ADM, by the founder of Archer Daniels Midland. I thought, boy, if you live in here for the last 100 years, everybody's lived here, been CEO. Well, I'm going to be one of the next CEOs because I'm living in the home where they lived. Now, here's where it gets a little bit messy. I told you it's a messy story with a good ending. Well, Ginger, my wife, became a Christian 10 years before me. She's seeing all these cars I'm buying. She's driving this 10-year-old Jeep. She's saying, boy, Mark, you're changing. I met Ginger when she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. She was 13, I was 14. We were in a school band. That's when we met. Went to all our high school proms together. I was senior class president. She was treasurer of the class. And knew her all through high school. And she said, Mark, you just don't seem to be the same man that you were in high school. You seem obsessed, almost addicted with all these things. I said, Ginger, don't you want another car? Why don't I at least buy you a new Jeep? I could buy you a Jeep with 2 days salary. She said, Mark, it's not about that. She said, my Jeep's fine. I want to keep my Jeep. Then she said, after a couple years with the company, almost 2 years with the company, it's April of 1992 now, a couple years there, the COO made it really clear, when he retires, I'm going to take his place. Another person 10 years older than me was going to be the next CEO, and I was being groomed to be the next COO. And that even came out and became front page of Fortune magazine, part of the succession planning that a public company does. So I was going to go from number four to number two. And the vice chairman came back to my office, and he gave me a $100,000 check 2 years after there. And he gave me 25,000 shares of stock warrants, about $1 million between those two. And I've already was getting some big bonuses well before that. But this was not at a time there was a performance review, so I thought it was a little strange to get $1 million when I didn't do anything. But I was so greedy, I wasn't going to chase him down and give it back. And he came back to my office an hour later, and I knew what the money was for. He said, Mark, you've been here a couple years now. We see you as family. We're going to share. We trust you now. You're part of the family. We're going to share how we do business. I said, I've been 2 years here, president of the biotech division, fastest growing division of the company. I know how you guys do business. He said, no, Mark, there's something we haven't shared with you. I said, what is that? He said, well, basically, we meet together with our competitors, and we have an international cartel, and we're fixing the prices of some of our key ingredients, fixing the prices. I said, Dwayne, that's against antitrust law. I mean, that's illegal. And he said, Mark, no one can be in the commodity business without doing this. We've been doing it for 12 years. You can't be in the commodity business without doing this. He said, those politicians that put those laws on the books, they don't know anything about business. This is the way business is done. I'm thinking, I'm 7, 8 years out of college. He's been CEO for 35 years. He knows a lot more than I know. So, plus he just gave me $1 million an hour earlier. So I'm hook, line, and sinker. He said, Mark, look, I'm almost 78 years old now. Keep in mind, he was 75 when I joined, almost 78 now. He said, we got to be mentoring some young people how to take this cartel over in the future. And we've picked you. But you're going to continue to move up. And at some point, you and Mick, the other one about 10 years older than me, said, you guys are going to be leading this company. And boy, I sure would love thinking about doing that. So I said, okay, I'm in. And they started mentoring me, started showing me how to do it. About a month later, listen to this, because this is going to be very important at the story as we move into it. A friend of mine, and vice president of ADM Mexico, and vice president of our sales of the biotech division, and myself, we lost money in investment, about $600,000. And the idea came out, well, let's just have the company reimburse us. So this was a personal investment. Yeah, but now you're part of the price-fixing scheme, and the company's earning an extra $1 billion a year, and you're part of that. So this is your part. You can reimburse yourself for the $600,000 that the three of us had lost. So we reimbursed ourselves for this $600,000, about $200,000 was me personally, from the company's money. Treated it like it was our own personal piggy bank. And there's nobody that could do anything about it because the three people above us are stealing $1 billion a year for 12 years in a row. But that's very important. So listen to that part and kind of keep that on hold. But that part on the $600,000 is going to be very important here as we talk about this later. So a couple months after that, my wife says, Mark, I've known you since you were in the eighth grade. She was in seventh grade. She said, you've changed. Something's changed here. What's going on in your life? So I started sharing with the woman I'd known since she was 13, I was 14. I said, well, look, they're mentoring me how to take over this big international cartel from all around the world. 12 years has been going on. We earn hundreds of millions of dollars a year, often $1 billion a year extra, each of us, each company. And Ginger, I'm going to be the next COO, the number two of the 56th largest company on the Fortune 500, $70 billion in revenue. She said, well, stop for a minute. What do you mean on this price fixing and antitrust? So I started sharing with her price fixing, what it means. Stay-at-home mom raising three young kids. She never heard of price fixing. So I told her how we get together our competitors, and she started sounded fishy. She said, Mark, is that legal? I said, Ginger, it's not legal, but here's what they tell me. Everybody does it, and if you're in the commodity business, this is the way business is done. She goes, boy, Mark, it just sounds dirty. If it's illegal, you shouldn't be doing it. She said, why would you do that? You spent all these years studying, a bachelor's, master's, Ohio State, PhD in biochemistry from Cornell in New York. You put invested all that time. You've worked hard. Why would you do this? Why would you cheat? I said, Ginger, this is the way it's going to have to be. If I'm going to move up, if I didn't do this, I wouldn't be able to stay with the company. They invited me in, and this is what I have to do. She said, Mark, I tell you, I'm going to have to go back and pray about this. She was a Christian about 10 years before that. And I was happy she was that because she was involved with her women's Bible study groups, with the church, and I could just keep working and keep getting bonuses and keep making $200,000 or $300,000 a month with bonuses. So she went back in the room, prayed about it, came back a couple hours later, and I thought, good, we put this behind us. I got to get on some of my price-fixing meetings because Japan's 12 hours ahead of us. We're fixing prices with companies in South Korea and Japan. So 8 o'clock at night in Illinois is 8 o'clock in the morning in Southeast Asia. So I had to get on the phone to do my price-fixing meetings. And she said, God led her to a decision. I said, what's your decision, Ginger? She said, well, you know, the FBI has been working on some cases at ADM, and we know the FBI, and, you know, they're solving these $100,000, $200,000 crimes, and they're and here's this billion-dollar crime going on that's been going on for 12 years in a row. She said, you've got to turn yourself in to the FBI. I said, Ginger, I turn myself in, I could go to prison for breaking federal antitrust laws. I said, the CEO is a billionaire, best friends with President Clinton, talked to President Clinton almost every week on the phone, flew to, on President Clinton's plane to go to President Nixon's funeral. I said, they will destroy us. And she said, you know what, Mark? My CEO is bigger than your CEO, and my CEO is Jesus. And I said, Ginger, well, my CEO lives 7 miles down the road, is a billionaire, and I can tell you they will destroy us. She said, God's going to protect us, but this is what you're going to do, and you're going to do it today. And if you don't do it, I'm doing it for you, but it's going to happen today. And I've known her since she's 13, and I knew there was no way out. I was had at that point. So I tried to talk her out of it, and finally she came after about an hour or two of yelling and screaming. She said, you know what? I was yelling and screaming, not her. And she said, you know what, Mark? I'd rather be homeless than live in a house where illegal activity is occurring. But this is going to happen, and it's going today. And I've already got the number, and I'm making the call. So we end up for 4 hours, late night, sitting with the FBI. How many of you went to the FBI and told them you're stealing $1 billion a year? Well, I can tell you that's an interesting reaction. That phone reached William Sessions, the director of the FBI. A few months later, Louis Freeh replaced him. William Sessions was still there then. It reached Janet Reno, the Attorney General. This became the largest price-fixing U.S. case in U.S. history, started by a stay-at-home mom raising 3 young kids. And I can remember sitting in front of the FBI, and the FBI say, now, what are we talking about here? And I can remember saying, I just wanted to weasel myself out of it. I can remember saying, look, this is not a big case. You got a lot more important things to do than this. This is not worth talking about. They said, well, how much money's involved? And I said, it's nothing. It's not worth talking about. And my wife said, $1 billion. And he said, $1 million? She said, no, $1 billion. He said, $1 billion? She said, $1 billion fraud. She said, $1 billion theft. He said, you're kidding me. He said, how long has this been going on? I said, you've got a lot more important things to do than talking to me. You've got bank robbers out there. You've got drug addicts. You've got a lot more important things to do than this. And my wife said, it's been going on 12 years. 12 years, $1 billion theft, 11 companies each earning $1 billion, so $11 billion a year for 12 years. When they got a hold of D.C. and Janet Reno, it became the largest price-fixing case in U.S. history, started by my wife, Ginger. 4 hours later, I had a choice after Ginger did all the confessing. I did all the lying and weaseling. 4 hours later, the FBI said, you got a choice. We got to arrest you today, or you got to start wearing a wire tomorrow after the people. You're only involved 7 months, Mark, the FBI said. We can get you out of this. You can become an informant, and you're only involved 7 months, and you go after the kingpins, we can get you eventually immunity, which they did. After a couple months wearing a wire, I had full immunity, never to do 1 day of prison, full immunity signed by the U.S. attorney in Chicago. So I said, okay, I'll wear the wire. I don't want to be arrested. I was a nervous wreck. So the next day, the FBI met me 6 in the morning, shaved my chest, put microphones to my chest, tape recorder on my back with an athletic band, another tape recorder briefcase, another one on a special notebook. They had three recorders in case one of them stopped working. They said, only about 6 weeks, Mark, you have to wear this. I met those FBI agents, four different ones, two at a time, rotating, 6 a.m, every day for 3 years. 10 hours a day. It wasn't 6 weeks. It was 3 years. Because once we started taping somebody, one of my co-defendants would say, yeah, we've been doing that on citric acid. We made $250 million on that last year. Another case. Then they say, yeah, we've been doing that on lactic acid, and we make about $15 million a month on that. Another case became 10, 11, 12 cases. Just one case right after another because they wouldn't shut their mouth. And I just want everybody to stop bragging about their illegal activity because it just became one case after another. And that's the difference, gentlemen, between a whistleblower and an informant. A whistleblower is someone who sacrifices everything to do the right thing. That's Ginger. An informant is someone sitting in front of the FBI and say, we either got to arrest you or you got to wear a wire. And that's me. And that's the difference between a whistleblower. If you read in the newspaper, a whistleblower versus informant, it's a huge difference. The informant's already caught. And he's got to start wearing a wire to get his way out of it. So that's a picture of Brian Shepherd, who I ended up working with for 3 years. I mentioned went 8 years of education, full scholarship, only child out of four to go to college, full scholarship at Ohio State, full scholarship in biochemistry at Cornell. And I threw that away. When I got involved with this illegal activity, I threw all that away the day I hit that fork in the road. These price-fixing meetings were all around the world. ADM felt safer outside of the country because antitrust laws were not what monitored as much outside of the country. So we were in Singapore. We had our own jets. We had seven jets. And we weren't allowed to fly on the same plane. So we three of us go to a price fix meeting. Phew, one plane land. I get off. Phew, another plane. Another guy gets off. Because they wanted to keep us safe. If something ever happened to a plane, you don't want to lose three top executives. We'd fly three planes in to go to a meeting. It was crazy. These were in Hong Kong, Mexico City, Vancouver. This lamp had the video camera in it. This is a real lamp. It had the video camera. Keep in mind, this is 30 years ago. It's not near the equipment they'd use today. So this green lamp had the video camera in it. The FBI, I would tell them where the meeting's going to be. They would be in the next room. They would get through a court order, get that placed in that room. If it was outside of the country, they'd meet with Interpol and the U.S. Embassy, and they'd change it from 110 to 220 voltage and get that green lamp in that conference room because they could control that video camera in that lamp by being in the next room. They could move it right. Whoever's talking, they could zoom in on that person when they're talking through that green lamp video. That green lamp, gentlemen, was in Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong. $1,000 a night hotel. Looks like it came from a yard sale, that green lamp. 5 feet closer from me in the front row, 5 feet from the 11 guys that are the price fixers. And they didn't notice it. 2 weeks later, we're at the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore. Same green lamp. Different country. Same 11 guys, 5 feet from them. 4 weeks after that, we're in Maui, Hawaii, playing golf. And then went into our price fixing meeting after we played a round of golf. Flew about eight planes to get there, all of us. And we played a round of golf. And went to the room, green lamp in there, 5 feet from us. 4 weeks after that, we're at the Four Seasons Hotel in Chicago. Same guys, having another price fixing meeting. Let's raise the price again. We start off at 60 cents. Let's take it gradually to $3.50 a pound. We'll make $1 billion a year each. That way each of us make millions in bonuses. That green lamp was at two or three meetings a month, the same 11 guys for 3 years. 5 feet from them. Thank God we did not have a woman criminal among us. Because if we had a woman criminal among us, a woman would have said, you know what, that green lamp has followed us around the world. But I tell you what it showed me. Greed blinds you. They saw dollar signs in their head and they didn't see what was 5 feet from them, which was that green lamp. Until a 7-week trial, 30 people getting convicted, and the green lamp gets brought in by the FBI and the prosecutors, and then they hit themselves in the head. Now they remembered the green lamp. Well, that's the video because they wanted to show a jury, not just hear the audio tapes I made, but they wanted to show video of this crime. Because one of these meetings was in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Atlanta airport. There used to be a hotel in 1993, a Sheraton right there. It's not even there today. It was a Sheraton hotel, and one of our price-fixing meetings was there. Someone knocked on the door. It was actually the hotel to bring in refreshments, iced tea and beverages and so on, in our conference room for our price-fixing meeting. They think it's just a real legitimate meeting. So they knock on the door, and one of the, keep in mind, the green lamp is rolling, the audio tape's on me. I got three different recorders rolling. And one of the defendants say, "Hey, I bet it's the FBI." Another guy said, "Oh, yeah, I bet we're all going to jail." And they all started laughing. They said, "The FBI is so stupid, they'd never catch something this sophisticated." That was all on tape played to a jury. When I saw that tape played, I could see the jury's mind. Those convictions are happening. And within an hour, 30 convicted. It didn't take long after a seven-week trial when the jury saw especially that kind of tape, because it showed that everybody knew it was illegal and they knew they'd go to jail if they got caught, and they were making fun of the FBI and laughing about it, stealing $1 billion a year from all of you because the consumers who paid that $1 billion a year. When Kellogg's pays more for ingredients or Pillsbury or Kraft, that gets passed on to the consumer. The consumers were paying that in the grocery stores. I had full immunity. Never go to prison one day, a deal of a lifetime, to wear a wire for 3 years. When the FBI said, when they wired me up, they say, "Mark, if these guys catch you, they're going to kill you." And they knew I was risking my life. And my third month wearing a wire, they walk in with a full immunity agreement that I'd never go to jail because they're so appreciative of what I was doing for the FBI. Wearing a wire for 10 hours a day, which I ended up doing for 3 years. So I had this deal of a lifetime, never to go to prison. So all of a sudden, we're the last 6 months, and they tell me, "Okay, it's about coming to an end. We're going to do a big raid on ADM. We're going to take their computers. We're going to take all the paperwork to prove what's on tape. We're going to get all the accounting numbers to show that the prices were being fixed. It's about to an end, Mark, this case." And I start thinking, but I'm not thinking very clearly. I'm wearing a wire. I lost 60 pounds. People at work thought I had cancer. I'm falling apart. I'm telling you, prison was a cakewalk compared to wearing a wire. I was falling apart wearing a wire for 3 years. Matter of fact, the FBI do not let an informant to wear a wire today longer than a year. And part of that was based on my case, new guidelines that came about, because they saw me falling apart. So they told me it was coming to an end. Then I started thinking, boy, at this point, I'm about 38 years old now. Great career here at ADM, making millions. But I got this house. I got this 8-car garage, probably got expensive, about 100 grand a month. How am I going to keep that up? And then I thought, who's going to hire somebody just wore a wire for 3 years against their company? And then I started thinking, well, how much money do I have put away? And I had a few million put away that I made legally. And then I thought, well, I'm going to run out of that in a year or two. And it may take me 5 years to get a job, if ever a job like that again, with wearing a wire against your own company. Easier to get a job as a felon than it is a whistleblower wearing a wire. So I started thinking, well, what's my stock options worth? And I had one worth $9 million. And it had about another 2 years before I could exercise a 5-year set of stock options. I could exercise it 2 more years. Well, the case was coming to an end before that 2 years. And then I started thinking, well, gosh, early on, before I even told Ginger about this, myself and a couple executives reimbursed herself with $600,000 with a snap of the finger. And they couldn't do anything about it because they're stealing $1 billion a year. If the county department goes and says, "Hey, these guys stole $600,000, what could they do? They knew we knew about the price fixing where they're stealing $1 billion a year. So I thought, well, I'm going to get my $9 million. I set up invoices, companies that I owned 100% of. They were just setting up dummy corporations. There wasn't any business ongoing. Made an invoice similar to like what ADM would process. The COO has to sign anything over $250,000. He knows what business we're doing, so he's going to know they're not real. But he's part of the price-fixing scheme. How's he going to stop me? He's not going to stop me. So one of them, the check was about $3.7 million for an invoice. He said, "Boy, Mark, I'm going to sign this. But you're getting a little greedy, aren't you? I think you ought to slow down." He signed it. So I did 5 of those. I had $9 million. I thought if they ever turned me in, ever down the road, I'd show these stock options that I have that are worth $9 million today. And I just cashed them in a year and a half early. That was going to be my defense, and that was my defense. It's not a good defense, by the way, because I tried it. So I had my 9 million. Thank God I went to Cornell and got a PhD. I'm the smartest guy in this room. I got 9 million set aside. I got time to get on my feet again, to get another job when they kick me out, when they learn I'm the one, the witness against them, the mole against them. So I thought, boy, I've got everything. I've got it all under control. I'm in good shape. The very day that ADM learned that I was the whistleblower, the very day, they called the FBI and said, he's no white knight informant. He stole $9 million from us. So then I tell the FBI, I said, no, I didn't steal it. They signed it. So they go to ADM and say, hey, you signed this for Mark. They say, yeah, but we thought there were real invoices. He duped us. We thought there was really consulting business that was done. We didn't realize he owned it. So the story changed. They were okay with it when I was with them. But once I wasn't with them, I was their number one enemy, and I put them in flames for price fixing. They were going to put me in flames for that $9 million. So the FBI come to my house, into the family room with my wife and I, and that's the first my wife heard about the $9 million. Thank God they were there. She would have killed me because I had full immunity before that. And the FBI said, look, Mark, we know the pressure we put you under. You should have never wore a wire 3 years. But this $9 million is complicated. It's a fraud. You can't exercise your stock options a year and a half early based on SEC regulations. You're in trouble. You're going to lose your immunity agreement. But we know you were making poor decisions under pressure. We could tell you're falling apart for 3 years, so we're going to go fight for you. And they went to the U.S. attorney in Chicago and said, look, Mark Whitaker helped solve a billion-dollar crime that was going on for 12 years in a row. Each company, $1 billion. And he stole $9 million, but he had stock options. They would owe it to him someday, and they used all the same rationalization, some of the arguments that I had. And the prosecutors agreed, said, yeah, Mark made some bad decisions under pressure. Let's give him a six-month sentence, a Martha Stewart sentence. 6 months in a federal white-collar camp, no wire. Just a white-collar camp, 6 months. Deal of a lifetime. My lawyer calls me in Chicago and said, Mark, he and the FBI got me a deal of a lifetime. I said, what is it, Jim? And he said, 6 months in prison. I said, oh, boy, 6 months. Seems like a long time. And then Ginger said, Mark, sign this thing. Let's put it behind us. Sign it. You go in at age 40, you come out at age 40. We'll have it behind us in 6 months. And I said, Ginger, you're the one that got me in this mess in the first place. You didn't have to wear the wire for 10 hours a day for 3 years. It's easy for you to tell the FBI, but look who's doing all the work. I'm going to do the opposite you want me to do. And I went up a foot from her face and ripped up that plea agreement, fired the lawyer who recommended it, went out and eventually hired over 11 lawyers, spent millions in legal fees, 11 lawyers, took the case through the courts for 3 years, thinking I'd use those stock options to get off the hook, and got a 10-year sentence 3 years later. And I had a six-month sentence in my hands. Well, a 10-year sentence and a federal sentence is a year and a half off, you get off good behavior, so it's 8.5 years. There's no parole in the federal system. That's state prison. So 8.5 years I'd have to do on a 10-year sentence. Wrote a 17-page letter to my wife, Ginger, and my kids, pulled my car in one of those garages and tried to kill myself. I could not imagine age 40 to age 49 in federal prison. I'd rather be dead. Not going to have a family when I get out. Not going to have a job when I get out. I'd rather be dead. I tried to kill myself. Our groundskeeper, who, when you have 8 acres and you're spending $10,000 a month just on utilities to keep your horse stable warm, our groundskeeper showed up at our house always at about 8:30 every morning. He showed up at 6:30 because our stables and our house was across the street. But he showed up across the street where our house was because he lived at the stables. He showed up at 8:30 or 6:30 that morning. But for 8 years, it was 8:30 every morning. He showed up at 6:30. I had a time where he would find me because our garage was detached from the house. I didn't want my family to find me. But he found me too early. I was unconscious, but I was still alive. And so they opened up the garage door, and he called 911, and the ambulance came, and I didn't wake up till I was in a hospital. The doctor said, based on my carbon monoxide levels, I was 20 minutes from being dead. But he came 2 hours too early. But 20 minutes, I would have passed. I was so mad at him. He spoiled my plan. Now I got to go to prison because of him. So I kept thinking, I'll find a way to kill myself before I still go to prison, is what I kept thinking. I'll make it effective the next time. So I'm hospitalized for a month, treated for post-traumatic stress disorder, some of the things that happen when you wear a wire, for 3 years. Treated, sent home. Judge gave me 7 months before I had to start my prison sentence to get my life back in order. Sent home, heavily medicated, especially for post-traumatic stress. And a man showed up at my house. His name was Ian Howes. And he said he was CFO of a pharmaceutical company. I'll show you a picture of him here. Oh, yeah, before I say that, I just want to mention this part of the story here has been what the movie was about and what some of the books were about. Two of the books came out my first month in prison. So it ends with me just going to prison. One by New York Times called The Informant. Another one by an antitrust lawyer called Rats in the Grain. My wife and I wrote a book called 10 Years Later with our whole faith journey, what I'm sharing here tonight. It's called Mark Whitaker Against All Odds. The Informant movie was based on the New York Times, but the New York Times book's like reading a John Grisham thriller, like the Firm. I don't know if you remember The Firm by John Grisham, and Tom Cruise played him in the movie. That's what the New York Times book was written like. All three of the books are serious dramas. But Hollywood decided to kind of make a comedic twist, like an Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, kind of Keystone Cop. And the FBI was so upset that they turned it into a comedy, they did a documentary to combat the movie 6 months later. And that's on my website, markwhitaker.com, the documentary. I think they're showing the documentary even tonight. I think they're sharing it. So that's Ginger and I with the guy who played me, Matt Damon. I know we're identical twins, and if you don't know which one he is, he's the one in the middle. If you don't know which one Matt Damon is. Because you can see we look just alike. Well, that's who played me in the movie. But the movie ends going to prison. It misses all the part that I'm kind of going to be sharing now, kind of the rest of the story. Did life end when I went to prison in 1998? I tell you, I thought life was in. I tried to kill myself. So I thought life was ending. I mean, I thought it was the end of my life. I couldn't imagine age 40 to age 49 in federal prison. And I thought, well, how's my family going to survive? I spent everything I had on this case, and I owed $9 million in fines. I owed $2 million on interest. I would have got a 15-year sentence if I wouldn't have paid that back. I said, we're going to lose everything through this. And all the legal fees that I had for those 3 years to get me that 8.5-year sentence, all the legal fees, I mean, we were broke. And I thought, my family's better off, me dead and alive. And that's when I'm getting back to this Ian Howes. He showed up at my house. He read about me in the newspaper. CFO of a pharmaceutical company. He said he was part of a group called CBMC. And I think it was a news agency like CNBC to interview me because I'm so used to being hounded by the media. He said, no, CBMC, Christian Business Men Connection. And he said, Mark, I've been reading about you. My wife's an attorney. We've got 5 kids. Most of them we adopted. Some of them from China. And he said, you've been on my heart, and I want to tell you something. Prison's going to be the beginning of your life, and you're going to find your true purpose in life with the journey you're ready to start. This was a month after I tried to kill myself, and 7 months before I go to prison. I thought this guy was crazy. Matter of fact, I went back in the house, closed the door on him, said, Ginger, there's somebody out there that's crazier than I am. She said, it can't be. I said, he said prison was going to be the beginning of my life. And I'd find my true purpose in my life with the journey I'm ready to start. She fell to her knees in tears. I'll never forget this. She fell to her knees in tears. And she said, thank God. God sent somebody. She said, Mark, I've been praying for you for 10 years. Your parents have been praying for you your whole life. And you've not listened to us. And I pray you go listen to this man who's out on the porch because God sent him. So I went out. I said, Ian, I'm going to prison in 7 months. He said, Mark, I know that. But he said, it's the beginning of your life. And you're going to find your true purpose, I'm telling you. And I said, well, Ian, what do you want to show me that's going to change this? And he said, I'm going to introduce you to Jesus. I said, Ian, I've been hearing about Jesus my whole life from my parents. And I said, I've been hearing from Jesus for Ginger for 10 years. And I said, I had professors at Cornell when I got a PhD in biochemistry. They said, if you believe in God, you can't be in my class. If you believe in God, you can't be a PhD scientist. And then I'm thinking, well, who should I believe, this guy that's up for a Nobel Prize or my parents who never went to college? So I said, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in it. I believe in evolution and Big Bang Theory and Darwinism. I had 8 years of that education. He said, well, Mark, just spend some time with me. He had a Bible study called Operation Timothy. It introduced me to God. Started off with, what's the purpose of your life? Next chapter was, do you think the Bible's credible? And he started going through that with me. 6 or 7 hours a week, the 7 months before I went to prison. And I tell you, it started giving me hope, and I didn't want to take my own life. It started giving me hope. And he started sharing with me. And we'd go through the book of John, for example. He said, Mark, Jesus died for your sins. He came to earth here as the Son of God, and he died for your sins. A horrific death on a cross. And then he rose 3 days later. And 48 days after that, he ascended into heaven. And you can join him for an eternal life. And I said, Ian, I want to believe this. I really do. But I've had too many scientists that tell me you can't believe in God. Don't listen to any of that. But it gave me some hope. So I'm in prison. Ian Howe still discipled me for 7 months, giving me hope. And this man showed up my second week in prison. He read about me in the Washington Post, just like Ian read about me in the newspaper. And he saw a lot of himself in what he read, he said. His name was Chuck Colson. He was special White House counsel for President Nixon, had an office next to the Oval Office in the White House. And he said, Mark, God put on my heart to come and talk to you because I saw a lot of your life. He went to Brown, I went to Cornell, both Ivy League schools. He became a lawyer. I got a PhD, both of us, doctorate level education. He became top of his game in his 30s in the White House counsel office under President Nixon. I was a divisional president of one of the biggest companies in the world at age 32. So he saw law parallels. And by the time he was 40, he was $20 a month in federal prison. And I was 40 going to federal prison for $20 a month. And he said, Mark, prison was the beginning of his life. And he started telling me some of the same things that Ian Howes told him, was telling me. I said, well, there's a guy been telling me this for 7 months. He said, Mark, have you surrendered your life to Jesus? If you've been told that for 7 months, I said, no. He said, why not? And I told him about the science block I had, that there were professors saying, if you believe in God, you can't be in my class. Some of them Nobel Prize level scientists. He said, Mark, you don't think there's a scientist that believes in God? And I said, no, I don't think there is. And he started sending me article after article, book after book of scientists, famous scientists that I knew their names of, that believed in God. Because I thought there was none that believed in God. I remember him sending me an article on Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein said, the Big Bang Theory is impossible. Only God could create the universe and mankind. And I thought, well, Albert Einstein's a pretty smart guy. But he sent other books like that. One guy named Don Byerly, a professor out of Minnesota, tried to prove to his friends for 10 years that God did not exist. An atheist. And he studied it and researched, and he was going to prove once and for all there's no God. 10 years later, proved it to him that there is a God and Jesus is the Son of God. And he wrote a book called Surprised by Faith. And I read that book, Surprised by Faith by Don Byerly. Finished that book in June of 98, got down on my knees in my cell, 3 months in prison, and surrendered my life to Jesus for the first time in my life a month after I turned 41. In a concrete floor, a locker, and a roommate. After a 13,000 square foot house and a mansion, I'm $20 a month for 8 years in a concrete floor, a locker, and a roommate. And I surrendered my life to Jesus because after I finished everything Chuck Colson said to me, I thought, how can you be a scientist and not believe in God? The scientific evidence was there. And then I started thinking, I said, well, both Chuck and Ian, by the way, Chuck came to see me about a Saturday a month for 8.5 years. Poured his life into me, became a father to me. He died yesterday, was 9 years ago. He died April 21st, 2012. And he was like a father to me, poured his life into me. And even when I got out in 2006, 15 years ago, we talked every couple days, poured his life to me until he died in 2012. So I looked at thought about, well, what's the purpose of my life? I'm now a Christian. I believe in you, God. Does that mean you're going to let me out of prison? I had 8 years yet to go. I'm 3 months in it. And I looked at that Bible that Chuck Colson gave me. I looked at those Operation Timothy books that Ian Howes gave me. And I thought, where in the world are people more helpless and hopeless than prison? And I started taking guys one through one, one by one, discipleship, the same thing they were taking me through. And those 8.5 years in prison, gentlemen, became the most productive years of my life, from age 40 to 49 at $20 a month. And if you don't think you want to break a greed addiction, go to earn $20 a month for 8 years. That'll break a greed addiction, because you realize how little you need and how more important other things are than all that flash that I thought I had. Those Ferraris now are rushed and rubbish 30 years later. But God and Jesus are eternal. I mean, after we're done here on earth, eternity is millions and billions and billions of years. And that's a lot more important than driving a car that 3 or 4 or 5 years later is garbage. So I started discipling these guys. And then some of them didn't have their GEDs. I helped them get their GEDs. Even a couple of them didn't even know how to write, and I helped them learn how to write. They became some of the most productive years of my life, because I'd never helped anybody else in my life until I went to prison. And I felt how rewarding that was to help somebody else. So basically, Chuck Colson and Ian Howes were correct. I did find the purpose of my life in prison. And I thought that'd be impossible. I didn't even want to live. I tried to take my own life. The companies, Ginger was about ready to move back at home with her parents, because we were running out of money. She was a stay-at-home mom. So all these companies, Coca-Cola, Tyson Food, Procter & Gamble, all these food companies, Kellogg, they sued ADM, and they won $3 billion back in class action suits. Coca-Cola alone, $400 million for the price fixing of high fructose corn syrup. $400 million, that was the largest. Those companies got together and said, hey, you guys, this has been going on for 12 years. If it wasn't for Ginger Whitaker, it'd still be going on today. And they put a whistleblower reward together for Ginger that financed her the entire time I was in prison. Paid my daughter's college, master's at Duke University, bachelor's and master's. My youngest son, MBA from Georgia Southern, paid for by the companies I stole from. Paid Ginger's house payment, paid Ginger's car payment. Any financial need she had, they paid it. Paid her to move everywhere I was. With good behavior, you move to a better prison. Ginger moved to all those places where she could visit me 20 hours a weekend, every Friday evening and all day Saturday and all day Sunday when I'm in prison. She moved to each place, 3 different states. Paid for by the companies I was stealing from. Miracle of God. In the book Against All Odds, they added up the days that Ginger spent sitting in federal prisons visiting me with my kids. And it added up to 3 years and 8 months that she spent 8-hour days. 3 years and 8 months. Every Friday evening and all day Saturday and all day Sunday. I watched my son. He was 6 years old, my youngest, when I was wearing a wire. He was 11 when I went to prison. He's 35 now, and I watched him about 1.5 years ago in an event in Cincinnati, about this many people, and he got up and he stood and he said, thank God, my dad went to prison. I got to spend 20 hours a weekend with him for 8.5 years, and he didn't even know what grade I was in before that. Talking about how blessed he was to visit me in prison because he had my attention. Finally, by that point, miracle of God that my 3 kids and my wife love me today. My wife and I are married in June, 42 years. The divorce rate if you go to prison is 78%. The divorce rate if you serve 5 years and longer is 99%, 30 years measured. 1% chance I had a marriage to survive, and we're married 42 years. Miracle of God. So the food companies took care of my family. My wife and kids stayed with me. My wife even took the money that the food companies were giving her, some of these whistleblower awards, and she became a school teacher at age 40. She became teacher of the year of her whole city in 2007. Miracle of God, paid for by the companies I was stealing from. The FBI agents and prosecutors started visiting me in prison. I've been out for 15 years, and I've done 7 events for the FBI. They brought me several times to Quantico because they've never had anybody wear a wire for 3 years, 8 hours a day. And they helped me train the agents about the pressure it was like to wear a wire 8, 9, 10 hours a day for 3 years. So I've done 7 events, even for the FBI, equipping them how to work with informants. These companies, Cornell, one of the professors became a Christian. Some of the companies like Coca-Cola, they started bringing executives into prison to visit me, like a college recruiting ground. And I got to study their patents and I got to look at their business plans and work with these companies just to keep my mind active while I was in prison. Four of those companies offered me a job the day I got out. Because I thought I'd never get a job. I tried to take my own life. I said I'd never have a family, wouldn't have a job, might as well be dead. That's why I tried to take my own life. So one of the jobs I took, I started a company with the CEO. I went with a company that was a cancer research company in California, the CEO, a Christian, because I didn't want to fall back into that greed trap addiction I had. So I took a job that a guy thinks long-term, 10-year-long clinical trials of a pharmaceutical company, biotech company, cancer research company. And I started like level right out of college at age 49. Four promotions over 10 years, I became the COO, the number two of that company. The number two. And I'm on their board today. Miracle of God. God redeemed it all, but this time to do it God's way, not my way. My way wasn't doing too well. So the company, then CBMC was one of the groups that reached out to me that I mentioned to you right before Chuck Colson. For 8 years, I was the COO of CBMC, Christian Businessmen Connection, along with being COO of the biotech company. In the last year and a half, the CEO of Coca-Cola Consolidated, now this is not Coca-Cola in Atlanta, Consolidated is the bottling part. It's a totally separate company. We're headquartered in Charlotte. And our purpose statement of Coca-Cola Consolidated, which is the bottling side, owning the 102 bottling plants in the U.S., the purpose statement is to honor God in all we do, to serve others, to pursue excellence, and to grow profitably, is the purpose statement of that company. For 22 years, God in the center. We have a chaplain in every plant. We have prayer groups. We have Bible studies. It's a ministry within an organization. Like I said, this is a different Coke in Atlanta. This is Coca-Cola Consolidated. We're on the NASDAQ. The other company's on the New York Stock Exchange. I've not been in a meeting yet at Coca-Cola Consolidated. We don't start with prayer. And so now I'm head of T-Factor. Coca-Cola reached out to me. And I'm head of T-Factor, which is transformation, to bring even more God in the company. In these plants, as they transform the culture to be a faith-friendly culture. Think about it. I'm working for the company 30 years ago I was stealing from. Miracle of God. Miracle of God. And to think about 30 years ago, heading a division that I was price-fixing and involved in an international cartel, now heading a division that's all about God. And prayer groups, and honoring God in all we do, and Bible studies, and we do discipleship called radical mentoring, where we take one for eight, and where one disciple's eight, and when that 1 year program's done, those eight become disciples, and they disciple another eight, and we multiply, and we do that within our organization, a faith-friendly, servant leadership, purpose-driven company. And that's what T-Factor is, the division that I'm responsible for at Coca-Cola Consolidated. You can see it on tfactor.com. website, you can see what that's about, but a very God-honoring, God-in-the-center company. That's my family today, Ginger and I, my three kids, and our daughter-in-law and son-in-law, closer and stronger than ever. 3 years wearing a wire, 8.5 years in prison, 99% divorce rate percentage, and that's my family today. Only God could take a life from ashes to beauty, like he did my life. And I can't wait to get up in the morning. Even when I was in prison, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning to see what God had in store and see who I could help get their GD or who I could disciple. The most important decision I've ever made in my life was surrendering my life to Jesus Christ on June 4th, 1998, at 41 years of age. Most important decision I've ever made in my life. I stand here in front of you today as a PhD scientist from Cornell University. God does exist. There's no doubt. And I've seen the evidence. I've seen the evidence. And not only have I seen the evidence that I've read, I've seen the evidence in my own life. With the 99% divorce rate, who I stole from, took care of my family. God does exist. My wife and I look back, what would happen if I would have signed that 6-month plea agreement that I was originally offered? All I had to do is sign it. My wife wanted to kill me when I didn't sign it. She was on CBS News in New York City when the movie came out in 2009, and I was doing another interview in California, and they asked Ginger, they said, Ginger, how'd you do it? She said, I wanted to run, and I wanted to leave, but God told me to love him unconditionally. Even when I didn't love him, God told me to stay. And she said, but how'd you do it, Ginger? She said, were you ever mad? And she was so mad, she wanted to kill me. She said, matter of fact, divorce wasn't an option, but murder was on national TV. And they said, when'd you want to kill him? She said, when he took a 6-month plea agreement and ripped it up in my face and said it was all my fault. She said, I wanted to kill him. She said, what would have happened? And this was a secular interview. This wasn't a Christian station. They said, what would have happened if your husband signed that 6-month sentence? She said, my husband would have came out the same greedy man he went in. He would have not listened to Ian Howes or Chuck Colson with a 6-month sentence. God gave him exactly what he needed, which was 8.5 years in prison. I would have loved to have been on that interview because I would have said 2 years would have been enough. But I do agree 6 months would have not been enough, and I would have never listened to Chuck Colson and Ian Howes with a 6-month sentence. Most important decision I ever made, and it took me being broken to get there. I'd like to end with a prayer that I prayed on June 4th, 1998, about 23 years ago, 41 years of age. I'd like to pray that prayer, and if you know God, pray along with me in silent and re-energize, renew your relationship with him. And if you don't know him, invite God into your life, into your heart. And pray along with me if you don't know him. But either way, you know him to re-energize. And if you don't know him, to invite him into your life. But let me pray the prayer that I prayed June 4th, 1998. God, I am a sinner. And God, I've made a train wreck of my life. And God, I know you sacrificed your only son to die on a cross, a horrific death for all my sins. I know that now, Father. I get it, and I've seen the evidence, and I get it. And Father, your son died a horrific death, and he was resurrected 3 days later, and he's in heaven today, and I know by believing in you, I will have eternal life with you in heaven, Father. I've made a train wreck of my life, Father, and what I'm asking you here today is for you to guide my life. You take the steering wheel and guide my life from every day forward. Because I've not done a very good job doing it myself. And Father, I need you because I've sure blown it when I've done it myself. So I'm asking for your guidance. I want to be spirit-led in all I do and all I say, Father. And I want you to guide every step of the way until I join you in heaven, Father. And I ask these things in Jesus' name. And amen.